This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. Please include this license notice with any copy or derivative of this work. Recorded on Wednesday, the 28th of January 2009, this is John Tan's talk, 80% Science, 20% Art.
Hi.
Before I start, I kind of want to get a feel. Well, there's two things really. First thing is that I don't really like talking at people. So I'd like this to be a kind of huge, great big panel in a way, because there's going to be a few guys in the audience who know more than I do about this subject in different areas. So if you know the answer, or if you've got a comment to make, just jump in anytime. You could always stick your hand up, but that made me feel kind of like a teacher. And it's been a few years since I did that. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, does anybody know what this is on the screen? Behind, the picture behind the title.
Printing.
Yeah, does anybody know which one?
The original
Heidelberg. Yes. No, does anybody know which flavour of Heidelberg?
Vanilla.
Original.
And very salted.
It's actually cranberry. So wrong, but it's actually a Heidelberg windmill, which and it belongs to, you can't really see it, but it belongs to a company called Yeehaw Industries. And guess where they're based?
Bristol.
Close. They're actually based in Knoxville in Tennessee. And they make really good letterpress, posters, stuff like that. So if you're ever in the market for one, check them out, because they're quite funny, mostly. So a little bit about me, because I always find it kind of arrogant to speak, because that people think they know who they are. So I thought I'd tell you, but this is me, by the way, on a good day. That's the professional photographer, and that's the kind of work that they can do. It's amazing, really. The reason that I like typography is because I love language. I love the written language. I'm not very good at it, but I do like it a lot. I like reading it, and I like finding out about it, and I like what it means to us and how it resonates with the work that we do. So on that note, just a quick split. Who's a designer in the audience? Okay, great. Okay, who's a developer? Who would count themselves as a developer? Okay, well, that's quite an even split. That's very strange. What are you guys doing here? Who's actually had formal training in typography or studied it? Ah. 1, 2, okay. So who will call themselves a typographer? Ah! Great, okay. Okay, so I work for a company called OmniTI. They're a company based in the States. And they're a big bunch of developers and techies. So I fit in, absolutely, straight off the gate. And that's my job. And I love tangerines and Toblerone. And I think that's pretty much as about as personal as I want to get right now with you guys. That's my mum, by the way. She still looks like that. So this talk, 20% art, 80% science, or 80% science, 20% art. The reason I called it that is because typography, and you could say design in general, and really anything that we do, any of the arts, which is most of the sort of disciplines that we're involved in, in my opinion, is 80% science and 20% art, and I'm going to explain why I think that. One of the interesting things about the word science is its roots, and you can see it there. I put it up there. And this is what I mean about loving language. Science has this thing called a Proto-Indo-European base, which means an assumed root around about, I think it's about, according to my notes, it's about 3,500 BC. Linguists assume this root to be a common language. And one of the words in it is, I don't know how to say that. Does anybody know how to say that word properly? Sky? Sky? Okay, we're going to say sky because I think that sounds better. And it means to split, rend, cleave. Interesting. To distinguish something, to break it down into its component parts to try and understand it. So I think you're all probably familiar with the scientific method, which has a rigor to it that I think we can all pretty much appreciate. And I'm going to kind of show you a little bit of how I think that applies to typography tonight. You probably recognize this dude. You might have seen him around. Obviously, Leonardo's famous Vitruvian Man. There's an argument that he actually based this sketch, really, which is what it is, sketch with notes, on a much earlier text, which was trying to link geometry with everything, effectively. And he did it in relation to the human body. And the reason I use this particular picture is because it's not really scientific, but and that's really my point, is that the science that we're going to use in typography isn't really that scientific. So art. Okay, this is from the Book of Kells, which, do any of you guys know it? Any of you guys actually seen it? Surprisingly. Okay, Jeremy knows what it is. Jeremy, how do you say this? Can you read that?
I can't read that.
It's the Gaelic name for the Book of Kells. Do you want to say it?
It's got Lauer in there somewhere. L-E-A-D-H-A-R, is that in there?
L-E-A-D-H-A-R.
That means book.
Chananas. I mean, it's just more smart. I was just interested. I didn't know how to say it. I'd read it, and I don't know how to say it. But the Book of Kells is probably the finest example of its kind. It's all of these kind of letters in it are amazingly intricate and amazingly illuminated. And this is obviously Cairo. And you just look at the amount of work that went into this. It's probably like one of the premium examples of calligraphy the Western world's ever produced. And dudes with shaved heads did this. I mean, it's kind of amazing. Sitting in one. I mean, obviously it wasn't a prerequisite. But my point about art is that the proto-Indo-Pyrian base of art is to fit together or join almost exactly the inverse or opposite of science, the base of science. So that's, that kind of interested me. I thought, well, that's interesting. So scientists take it apart and artists put it back together again. And hopefully make it slightly better. So what does this mean for print? You guys seen this poster? This is one of Yeehaw Industries' finest. I mean, it gets better and better the more I look at it, to be honest. You know, I just picked up windbags, but you know, it's pretty good. You can actually buy this too, although obviously I don't get any affiliate commission, just in case you're wondering. But my point really in showing this is that Yeehaw Industries are kind of very good printers, they're very technical printers, but they've gone past the point of being technical into doing sort of fun stuff like this. And making a business out of it, and still being really precise and doing interesting things with type. So, what does that mean for web typography? Any of you guys seen the site recently? Mm-hmm. Okay, all right, so a couple of you. It's Theodore Rosendorf's new book, only book, I think, The Typographic Desk Reference. And he did this website for it. Now this book really interests me because you know it's got loads of useful information that I probably really geek out on. I probably read it on the loo, you know, and enjoy it and stuff as guys do. You know, it's like that or the sun. So this is his site that he put up the other day, and when I went to the site, I was like, oh, that's interesting, because that's what's behind it. So let me just flip you back again. One sec. That's his site. And take away the images in the CSS, and that's what you get. And it gets better as you go down. So via Twitter, I sent Theodore a little message. I said, Theodore, you saw that shit. Can you edit that, by the way, in the podcast? Thank you. Because he's actually a nice guy. But and I said, look, you know, you need some help. And his response was something I've heard quite a lot from the print typography community, in a way, was kind of like, well, I kind of threw it together and it's just kind of the web, I'll get around to it. It's just kind of disappointing to me, but he is interested in help, so if you also want to harass Theodore via Twitter with help, feel free, and I think you could use it, judging by this. I mean, this is a tables-based site that all text for his beautiful type is spacer. Is that word appear now? Just curiosity. And there's no hierarchy here, there's no headers, there's nothing. There's nothing that's helping him fundamentally sell his book anyway. I mean, I would have bought it, but I'm pausing until such time as he gives me one for free for telling him his site is shit. I'm not sure how that's going to work out. So let's let's kind of focus in a little bit here. Can anybody, I didn't blow this up enough, so it's my fault, I apologise. But can anybody see or think of a reason why he's put all this text in an image?
Because of the ligatures.
Right, okay.
The systems and thousand facts.
The justified text and IC justified.
That's a good reason.
Small caps of TBR.
Anybody else think of a reason?
My friend song implemented, yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's what probably what his tool gave him. So that's actually probably the most pertinent answer. And actually, the penultimate one was obviously the most pertinent too. He wanted to use a particular typeface, and I know Rich is going to go through this stuff within detail later, and much better detail than I would give him in this presentation. But that's what he wanted to do. He wanted just to use the ligatures. He wanted, well, ST I put up there, but I left out the CT ligature, which is hanging around somewhere. I can't even see myself here, facts. So he wanted to use a typeface, and he wanted to use ligatures. So instead of kind of finding a way to do this or doing any research, he just chucked this page together and threw it out there. And it's like, it looks really pretty. Aesthetically, you wouldn't even notice unless you dig behind it. But, you know, it's a disappointment to me that digging behind it, I find such rubbish. So, guess where this is from? So it's from Apple. Can anybody tell me what's wrong with this? Thank you very much. Yeah, that's kind of obvious, but I just thought I'd ask you. This is Georgia, Matthew Carter, Microsoft. And someone at Apple's gone and made it an oblique. And I mean, it's not that offensive. It doesn't doesn't make my stomach turn over or make me cry or anything like that, but when I first saw it, I was like, why? Yeah.
John, yes. Can I interrupt? Maybe we're just talking about what the difference between oblique and italic is.
Yeah, no. Good point. So, who knows? Who else knows the difference between an oblique and italic? Who wants to explain it? This is what I mean about being a little bit. Who wants to explain it, anybody?
I'll have a go.
I didn't pick you. Yes, I'm going with the man in the back. See yourself scolded. Go ahead, man.
So oblique has just been sort of sloped over. It's based on the normal, like, standard typeface, whereas specifically designed particular shapes that work well when they're sloped.
Yes. Fundamentally, yes, exactly so. So what they've done is they've taken a regular Georgia, which will be upright, effectively, and just gone. Obviously, without the sound effects, but that's effectively what we've done. So this is what they had originally. As soon as when the new MacBook Pros came out, I think, I went to the site to have a look, wanting one, and this is what I saw. And then, miraculously, after various complaints from a few people and a bit of whinging on Twitter, we got that. We got italic. So, I mean, you might think it's not really that important, but obviously someone at Apple thought it was important. And enough of a gaffe to say, okay, can we just correct this? It'll take 2 seconds, and they did. And that's fine. But this brings up an interesting point for me. Is anybody here familiar with font synthesis? Apart from Rich, the god of font synthesis. has anybody else come across it at all, ever? Okay, so it's in the CSS specifications, various ones. And what it basically says is that you can, using CSS, you can tell the browser to synthesize a particular font in a particular style. So, I know, Rich, you're going to mention this later, so I don't want to steal your thunder, but there is a particular, very famous typeface that Apple have had for eons, which does not have an italic. It doesn't have an oblique, it doesn't have an italic, it doesn't have anything like that. But we're allowed, using CSS and the browser, to force it to have an italic. Actually, to force it to have an oblique, to be precise. To force it to lean over. Now, this is kind of could be considered to be a really good thing, because that means you can take any typeface you want and you can manipulate it using CSS. So you can't just you can actually force it to have an oblique. You can force it to have small caps. You can force it to do all sorts of things that it's not wasn't designed to do. But my question, I guess, to you guys is: do you think it's a good thing? Does anybody think it's a good thing? Useful?
It depends on the alternative. If there is a better alternative, then it would be great to have the better alternative. But in light,
Well, the alternative would be not to do it. That's one good alternative. Is, I mean, the world would not die if you didn't have an oblique version of a particular typeface, would it?
I think if the user wants to uglify their document, then they should be entitled to. Well, it pays a sort of, you know, rather esoteric knowledge of how to do it properly. But I think we should restrict the capabilities or like
it. Okay. So my argument would be that, and both those are valid, by the way. But my argument would be that a designer of a typeface, first of all, spends a long time considering what they're doing, and they do it really for their own benefit, for their own gratification, but for the benefit of the people who use this particular phrase. And if you allow people just to basically hack it, you know, you're stripping away the care and consideration that went into it. And it might still function on many levels, and actually that's probably why we allow it to do, because most faces do still function on many levels. But fundamentally, there's always better alternatives. And just because I asked you guys if you know what font synthesis was, and it was interesting that no one really knew what it was, apart from Rich, I think, because we talked about it earlier. But on the converse side, you're probably all aware that you could open up a particular software program and play with fonts and make them do stuff, i.e. make them slope over, make them heavier and bold, make them all capitals, even probably maybe make them small caps. But I'm not sure if it's a good thing or not. I'll leave that to you guys to decide. Now, what this means, though, is there are endless possibilities. Don't you just love Bruce? I mean, I feel like this is a movie because, you know, that actually kind of animates and this flashes and, oh man, this moves in and out and, oh, it's got such great...
Is that someone's MySpace,
mate? No, this is Bruce's entry for the CSS Zengarden.
This is Bruce Lawson's entry for CSS Zengarden. But yeah, I mean, it was GeoCities. I mean, it's a very small type, which is, again, I set it too small, but it's a GeoCities spoof. And I think, do you all remember GeoCities?
Yeah.
What a great joint that was. That was something else, man. Validated animated GIFs for at least 30 years. So there's endless possibilities, and I guess my point with synthesis is that I'm using this to illustrate a point that synthesis, the wide open nature of CSS and typography on the web isn't necessarily a good thing. Not because people shouldn't be entitled to do something like this, they should if they want to. If that's their style, that's their taste, fair play to them. But if you don't enforce any kind of rigor around an exercise that people undertake, like design, or like development and writing code, then you have no design pattern. You have no mental pattern in order to apply to what you're doing, to understand it, and therefore to fully grasp it. It's equivalent to the paradox of choice. You guys come across that term?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's what we've got at the moment. We've got the paradox of choice. And it's a problem.
Yeah, but the thing with the paradox of choice is it's the paradox of undifferentiated choice. When you present with lots of options, there's no differentiation. Paradox of choice falls apart as soon as any kind of differentiation, like a friend suggests something or most people will go for something.
Sure.
And if, let's say, we do have a field wide open for typography, as long as you have experts or somebody saying, this works, this doesn't, then you've got, you know, in areas where people who care can say, well, I'm going to go with what obviously works and I'm going to ignore the rest. I don't think you necessarily need to ban the other stuff from being available.
Well, maybe not, but actually I don't listen to experts too often, I've got to be honest. And I'm constantly confronted there by the paradox of choice, because I don't have any of those sort of other options, or I don't really pay much mind to them. And that costs
you. You listen to your peers, your friends, your family?
Well, you do soak in influences, don't you? Of course you do. But I think one of the problems is, has anybody here, let me flip back a second, leaving that out there. Does anybody here remember Publisher when it was first released on the Windows platform? Did anybody ever play with it? Yeah, did anybody ever play with it and play with it and play with it and play it to death? Like a game. Constantly rearranging stuff, constantly moving stuff around. Rearranging it and moving it around. And at some point, there was kind of a calculation that was made. Oh, I'm sick of doing this. I need to do something. So that'll do. Print. You know, that's kind of one of my arguments about the openness of it all. If you don't have a rig in which to understand it, you just carry on playing until such time as you either lose momentum or just need to get a job done. And that's where you end up, rather than having a kind of end point to aim for and a standard or a rigor to apply to. So there are some better than others. Richard's site, I mean, okay, you know, whether I'd be here on ground or not, I'd still put it up there because I really appreciate this. And I really appreciate the fact that someone's taking the time to actually convert a seminal book to the web and try and give us this this really useful bit of information. Other sites have better than others as well. It's a guy in there called Pascal Klein, who's a real he loves typography. And some others you'll probably know. Do you know Jeff Grofstein?
Yep.
Visited there? Jeff does typography stuff. And of course, I couldn't do this without including Mr. Samson Weir, even though he's everywhere. Well, you've got to include him because of the stuff he's doing. Have you visited his site recently? Does everyone know what's going on over there? He's styling in. He's got some default styles that he applies to articles. And then as they come in, he styles each one individually. He basically art directs an article individually as he writes it. I'm not sure whether he's writing them so that he can art direct them or art direct them after he's written them. But that being the case, he's still doing some really good work. So there is hope, basically. There is really good work out there. People doing really good stuff.
Can I just throw another one in there? Which it suddenly occurred to me. I think his name Ryan Sims, Just Watch the Sky, his website is.
Yeah.
He's using a Tumblr theme, basically. He uses song lyrics and as a day's post. So he'll pick one lyric and style it typographically. That's very much worth a look, I think.
But he also restricts himself to only to Georgia and Helvetica.
Right.
Yes.
Does
anybody else got any really good suggestions? I'm constantly looking for really good examples on the web. Does anybody else got sites that they've been to or know well that they think this typography is fantastic?
There's an agency in Sweden called Monk, M-O-N-C .se, and the guy behind it wrote a framework, CSS framework, called Tripoli, which, whatever your opinions on CSS frameworks are, I think the treatment of typography is very, very nice, and it sort of proliferates that word across his work.
Monk, M-O-N-C.
M-O-N-C, yeah. Okay. I think he was the guy who was originally behind Style Gala and DevKick and a couple of sites like that, which they're really nice.
M-O-N-C. I just threw this up there because I love the picture. The idea of auto polo. I mean, it's just so fierce. What an idea. First of all, you've got to be absolutely stupidly rich. You've got to be so rich it makes you stupid, really. To be able to, in that particular era, to think, oh, right, let's go and play polo with cars. And holy cow! Look at the poor dude. He's just golden. He is going to be physio. Yeah.
So it's a
Nissan
on the left.
Yes! It looks very much like it, doesn't it? But anyway, I love the picture. I couldn't resist. There's obviously a huge crowd there for water polo matches as well. It's not popular in that particular era. So that's good. Just to get to the nitty-gritty, that was kind of the preamble, really. The nitty-gritty of the science, for the web at least, breaks down into kind of four little sections, really. And I only did them bite-sized, deliberately so, because I wanted to have a bit more of a conversation with you guys about this stuff. By the way, these pictures are from, just as an aside, these pictures are from Flickr, and they're part of the comments, and they're all from, I think it's the Library of Congress. And they're all taken during the Second World War. And the interesting thing about the pictures is that these are all real people. They're not models. But they were made up and they got dressed up and they went and kind of positioned themselves like they were working on engines for Douglas, the airplane manufacturer on the west coast of the States. And they took all these pictures of propaganda shots to try and encourage people to get involved in the war effort. Just for your information. So, choosing faces. Okay, so there's an eternal debate, sorry for us as science, about the web, about legibility generally, and I'm going to touch on that in a little bit more detail in a second. But then you've got the eternal options of the core web fonts, which do you guys all know what they are? Are you aware of the core web fonts? Okay. Firstly, is anybody else? Is anybody not? I don't want to kind of leave you behind, anybody. Okay. Cool web fonts, and then you've got font stacks or matrices, and then you've got @fontface. My view here, and this is a very opinionated view, as you probably notice, is that the core web fonts are integral to what we do in every kind of respect, and they should be respected, they should be cherished, they should be curated properly. What do they do?
So much for caffeine.
I think it's a good. Hold on one sec. There we go. I think we're good. Okay.
You got caffeine on
it? No, enough memory. I may not have enough memory to play the slideshow at current resolution. Oops. I broke it. Anyway, sorry about that. The core web fonts have basically been neglected since 2001. Nothing's been done to them at all. They're used every day on millions, if not billions, of pages all over the world, and no one cares about them. And I've got a problem with that. What Microsoft did, Microsoft sold the rights to the core to develop the core web fonts to Ascender Corp, I believe, if memory serves me right. And Ascender now have the rights to develop the core web fonts. And what I mean by develop is they have the rights to produce small caps variants, and they have the rights to extend them, to add glyphs, add language support, to do whatever they want with them. And what have they done? Nothing. Nothing at all. Not a thing. This is a real problem. This is the tools of our trade. But we use them anyway, and I'm still a fan of the core web fonts, and I still use them as much as possible in my work. Even though the fashion at the moment is to get all interesting matrices, I still rely on the core web fonts. Because I don't think you need more than a few typefaces in your arsenal in life, ever, to do a really good job. And a student recently sent me an email, about 2 days ago. She's a student at Bath University. And she said, John, please help me. And this is almost verbatim. She said, please help me. My lecturer has told me that I've got to use as many typefaces as possible in my work. And that I'm not allowed to use the core web fonts on the web. So my response was very simple. Did you pay for this course?
Was this Bath University, you say?
Pardon?
Was this Bath University?
Yeah.
You say? Yeah, my friends took the same course.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Dora Kalbach. She actually came to me in the same question, actually.
Did she?
Yeah.
Ah, it may well have been her. What's her name?
Laura Calvay.
Doesn't ring a bell, but... Maybe there's two on the same course who've got exactly the same problem. Does anybody else... I mean, I've got to confess to you guys, I didn't do a degree in design. I'm not a formally trained designer in any sense. I'm completely self-taught. I went and worked with other people and just did my thing. Has anybody here done courses in design that were any way similar to that? What was your web element like? It was print-based. What was the regard for the web on your course, and when did you do it?
Too long ago, no, it wasn't anything considered for the web at all, really.
I'm assuming you don't mean 1965.
No.
That would be incredibly handsome for your age.
It wasn't taught at that time.
Okay, it wasn't taught at all at that time.
I haven't done a design course, but I've talked to a few people who have done various different sort of design-related courses. Mm-hmm. And the bit that's... bit where they talk about the web is basically here's how to put your portfolio online, and that consists of how to use Flash, and that's it. That's the internet.
Right.
So, okay. It's all pretty screwed up and out of date.
You're really scaring me.
John, can I chip in with kind of the flip side of that?
Go.
You know, plenty of people who have been doing webby design, masters in HCI or whatever, and they don't know anything about typography either. So it's not being met from either end.
Okay, so it's falling through a grate.
Yeah,
okay. I think as well with the university lectures, you've got to remember when I'm being a bit older. I remember when writing Poly, as it was, took on its first group of Macs, and the head of graphics at the time told his students not to touch them at all because they'd never be used in typography or design.
Do you know what? If my Poly had had Macs, dude, I would have nicked them. If that was the case, I would have been like, right, I'm having one then. Okay, so I'm really flagging just to raise your awareness with the core web fonts. I mean, you might see a campaign starting shortly to try and do something about this, because I think it's a real crime. But let's just flick on the stacks. I know that Rich is going to go through stacks in a little bit more detail with you later. And I find them really interesting. But there's a problem with font stacks, and that's that you're juggling different balls in the air for different platforms and different browsers and different scenarios, and hopefully they're going to have this, and hopefully they're going to have that, and hopefully it's going to fall back to somewhere good. It gets complicated, and I think as Rich will demonstrate. And now, at FontFace. Have any of you guys read about this recently? Do you know what it is? Okay, I've been writing quite a lot about it, because I've been trying to do some tests on this. At FontFace basically allows you to include what typographers on a typewriter are calling linking. It allows you to link to a font file, which is a big crime, apparently. But it allows you to link to a font file, include that in your web page, and have the page styled, have the page use that typeface. There's two distinct strands to our FontFace at the moment, or two distinct camps to how it might be used. The first camp is where all rational people are. I thought it was going to be opinionated. Which is really, we should just open this up a little bit. We should open it up a little bit in the same way that we should open music up a little bit. You're going to get some people who, for want of a better phrase, take the piss and steal a font, steal a typeface, and use it without paying for it. But I think by and large, I think time has shown us that most people are fairly decent. And if they're going to use something commercially, they're more than willing to pay for it commercially as well. And even if they're going to use it privately, they're willing to pay for it as long as it's sufficient quality. And I've got to tell you that amongst professional grade typefaces that I come across, and I, bear in mind, can't design them, but the ones that I come across, they're more than worth paying for the licenses that are charged. So that's one camp. One camp is open it up, make it available to us, let us use it. The other camp is don't, I'm scared. The web's a big bad place and the people are going to steal my stuff and I'm never going to earn any money from it. And I actually sympathise with that view to a degree, so I'm not entirely one-sided on this. I sympathise with that fear that if you put your love and your heart into a typeface and you've designed it for 6 months and you've worked on it constantly and it really is your baby, you know, you don't want some geezer nicking it and using it for whatever without paying you. So what the alternative they're promoting or that's been discussed is embedded OpenType. Do you guys know about embedded OpenType? What embedded OpenType is, just in a real summary, because Rich is going to go through this again a bit later in more detail, is you've got an OpenType font format. And around that OpenType font format, you surround it by a layer, which is basically a layer of security. And that layer of security only, supposedly, allows it to be used on one domain. And you can do other stuff with it. You can do stuff like not let anybody look at the typeface, supposedly. And you can also create subsets of the typeface, which I probably won't go into. But what it basically means is that you wrap an OpenType or a TrueType font in an embedded OpenType container and then link to that. Because apparently that's supposed to protect the typeface. Well, guys, it doesn't, because people have already reverse engineered that. And it's not even really been widely accepted yet. So that's at FontFace. This is the future, hopefully, for us. But at the moment, it's bereft of those kind of problems, which have been worked out. And there's actually a W3C proposed working group called the Fonts Working Group, which hopefully will help us through these troubled times. So choosing faces, you've got a choice, sans versus serif, if you really want to make that distinction. You've got a choice of what type of faces you use and what kind of formats and where they come from. But then you've got X-Height. Does anybody know what X-Height is? Most people know what X-Height is? Okay. So just to explain, X-Height, guys, is that, just to be really visual, the height of a lowercase glyph. And the reason it's important is because if you look at a lot of web typefaces like Georgia or Verdana, they have big X heights. They have large X heights to make them as legible as possible. So inside and some people will know this, but inside a letter O, you have a hole, which is called a counter. And if you make the X height bigger, that hole gets bigger. Supposedly makes it more legible, especially when that font is at small sizes on the screen. So X-Height is important when choosing a face on the web because it impacts on everything else that you do from that point. So if you've chosen a font with a low X-Height, for example, you have to set it at a higher size, otherwise it won't be legible on low resolution screens. And then you've got styles you can choose from. There's loads of different styles. I'm not going to even try to take you through them all because some of them I don't understand. And I really tried hard, and I still don't really understand them properly. But there's loads of different styles of fonts you can choose. And then the last one is probably the thing that most people aren't paying any attention to at the moment, or I can't see a lot of attention paid to it, which is actual screen performance of a typeface. And the main thing about the influence is that is how that face is hinted for the screen. Most typefaces, majority that I think are out there in the wild, are optimized for print, and very little love is given to them for the screen. So you try and include them with that font face, and they break. And what I mean by break is, bits will be missing at lower sizes. So a letter A has a bar, and on recent tests, lower sizes, that bar disappeared out of one of the typefaces that I was testing. Just went, okay, it's not a letter A anymore, it's kind of just some kind of pointy thing. So hinting is really important, and hinting specifically for the screen is really important. So it can seem a little bit complicated. There's loads of other things you can take into consideration when choosing faces for the screen, for the web, and there's some of them. Does that make sense to people? Does anybody want to ask me anything about that? Or make a comment about that at all? Okay. So, Sarah from Sands. Again, I can't resist these pictures. I mean, look at these two guys. And this is A.A. McLean. Did you know that? That's his name. The referee is A.A. McLean. I've got no idea who he is, but it just took me to that. anyway, I love this picture. So, do we know what this says, this line of texting?
London,
London
is the world's capital of gourmet
junk. Very well done. Very well done. You guys are really optimal. You've totally ruined the next two slides. No, I mean, it's good that you can work it out, but many can't. So, there's a SERP in Georgia. Starts to make a little bit more sense. But this is taken directly from a book, by the way, a really good one, which I have hanging around somewhere, called Detail and Typography, by a very famous book designer called, I think his name's Jost Hutchuli. Anybody read it? You read the book? Highly recommended to you for the web. Really, really interesting stuff. And so I'm just reproducing it for your benefit. But then suddenly, if you switch to the upper half of a line of text, suddenly it starts to look a lot clearer. And then upper half serif, it starts to look even clearer still. What does this mean? I'm not sure. I am sure, actually. But and yeah, you're right. Colombia is the world capital of gourmet junk. The reason I give that demo is because the argument has often been that sans serifs are much more legible on the web. And serifs are not. And there's been good reason for that, because we've had very low displays. So serifs have been horrendously mangled, especially by Windows, for a very long time. But actually, in print at least, and someone please feel free to contradict me here or jump in with any extra info if you have it. In print, there's a reason we use serifs most of the time. It's because they are more legible. Another thing that Jost Hutchuli talked about in his book is a thing that will be familiar to psychologists. Or even usability guys in the audience. Have you heard of saccades? Anybody heard? Have you guys heard of saccades? Okay. So a saccade is, I was going to do a slide to demonstrate this, but I ran out of time, so I'll just try and do it for you. A saccade is an actual scientific way of understanding how people read. And this is not just how we read, but it's how we actually see the world. What happens is when we're reading a line of text that we skip along the line like this. And each of those is basically called a saccade. And what it means is that we don't read the whole thing. We're just skipping along this line, understanding it with brief glimpses. And each there's a pause, a very minute pause at certain places, as we just take in that brief bit and we move on. And the reason this is significant for sans versus serif is because serifs are much more... Let me go back. Serifs are much easier to distinguish than sans, because of the serifs. And the serif being little things like this, and like that, and like that. tell us a little bit more information about what that glyph is. And we all read as a card. So if we're reading as a card and we've got a decent enough resolution browser, then there's no reason why anybody in the world should say that a sans is more legible than a serif. You might have preferences, but that's fine. But don't, if you read that, don't believe it. You know, I think that's the point of what I'm trying to say. So choose whatever you like. So, I call this the Raster Wars because there's a great, huge difference at the moment between how different operating systems treat typefaces. Any of you guys ever noticed this? Mm-hmm. Okay, what have you noticed? What are the main things that you've noticed?
Windows looks revolting by the holy crap.
We're just not supposed to say that, though.
Seriously, I don't know, is Vista improved? But XP, certainly.
No, Vista's not.
You load up an XP box, and if you haven't checked the clear type box deep within the preferences, everything looks terrible.
Why does it look bad?
Because they're not doing the sub-pixel anti-aliasing trick.
He's very smart, isn't he? You want him in the room when if you're feeling a bit tired or something. You just step right in. No, I mean, you're right. You're right. And so let me, I'll try and explain what's actually going on behind the hood here, though, a little bit more about the science of this. So this is IE7 with ClearType switched on XP Pro. I don't know if you guys can see, I'm not sure if it's particularly clear, but all around the top of here, you can see jaggies, what people will call jaggies, which is basically pixelated edges. Can you actually make that out? I'm not sure if you can. Apple's compensated for it, obviously, by smoothing out for us. Thanks. Thanks, Apple. Okay. But the same applies here on Vista. And if you could see it, here on standard rendering, not clear type, on standard rendering, this is absolutely smooth. Relatively smooth, almost Apple smooth. So there's a difference, right? But there's a difference between different versions of rendering within Windows itself. But on that, it gets even a little bit more complicated. Windows has a thing called the Graphic Device Interface. I love it when technicians come up with names like this. It's supposed to be really descriptive and really just confuses the hell out of everybody. The graphic device interface is really just the thing that renders objects and text for Windows. Now, if anybody can expand that explanation, I'd really welcome it. It's not particularly my area. But they have this thing anyway called the GDI. And they've got a new updated one, which is called, I know what the acronym is, Windows Presentation Foundation.
Yeah.
It just gets better. So the Windows Presentation Foundation, according to my insider guy, inside of Microsoft, is much, 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 much improved. But the problem is, none of the applications, or most of the applications on Windows, don't use it. So it's not used to man or beast. So the problem is that the GDI interface cannot render text smoothly at larger sizes. But sitting on top of that, used to be this thing called standard rendering on Windows, and it could. The problem with standard rendering is, at lower sizes, it couldn't do any smoothing or anti-alias at all, which is probably what you're referring to. So the point of all this is, I mean, there's a whole article of this on my blog, and very long, and took ages to write, and geeked out on it ever so slightly. But my point about this is, there's variations even within Windows. So it's not just a Windows Mac split here. This is a Windows version and Windows-specific application versions sitting on top of different Windows version split. It gets complicated. And this is Firefox 3 sitting on top of OS X. And Firefox uses Cairo for drawing, which sits on top of Apple's rendering engine, equivalent of GDI, which is called Atsui. So, has anybody ever heard of any of this stuff before? Is anybody else familiar with it? Okay, you guys are familiar with it. Do you have any knowledge that you could share with us that would expand my understanding even? Small than it is.
Not the Mac, the Windows
part. Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, no, I mean, tell us.
So the Windows Presentation Foundation you were talking about is a completely new piece of technology, and it'll be at least 2 or 3 years before people start writing applications with it seriously and get out into the real world. So it's going to be a long time before you start to see that tier of applications come through that produce nicer text.
Okay. So that's what I'm informed too. So I spoke to the guy who's a head of research at Microsoft on rendering on the browser. And on the platform generally, and he told me that the only thing that he could point me to that was using it now was the Times Reader, built in Silverlight, that commissioned by the New York Times. So I went and looked at Times Reader, and I couldn't bear to show it to anybody because it was equally as bad. And I didn't bother telling him either because I just thought I'd sort of deflate him slightly because he was actually really chuffed that the Times Reader was using the technology. Well, my point anyway is when considering type for the web, we have to take all these things into consideration. It gets kind of complicated.
John, just a quick question. You talked about Cairo. Mm. Has the font rendering of Firefox improved then? Because it's traditionally really shit.
It has. I mean, I don't know if you guys ever noticed, but Firefox used to make typefaces fat.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so they did change it, and it has actually improved. It's actually a lot better, and actually it compares favourably with Safari for me now. My way of looking at it.
That's because it uses the same text rendering now as Safari, whereas before it used effectively the OS 9 rendering. It wouldn't render any PostScript fonts at all. It would completely mess up italics in terms of the spacing. It was a mess.
So they basically outsourced it.
And now it's basically
it,
the same as Safari.
Yeah. So.
And that was a version.
Between that changed between versions 2 and 3.
2 and 3, yeah. So. And seeing as Mozilla don't support a browser for longer than 18 months, is it now? That means effectively that we're pretty much coming to the end of that old support. So, anyway, you know, it was really just an illustration, guys. There's so much I can say on this, but I don't want to kind of bore you to death, put you to sleep. Broke it again. God, I'm good at this, aren't I? Yes.
Quality Apple hardware.
Let's see.
There we go.
Ah!
No.
Okay. Otherwise. Oh, it works. Okay. On to a little bit about the grid. Has anybody seen this poster before? Because I really want someone to tell me how to pronounce this. Vormgevers in Dutch. Is it Vormgevers? Okay. I keep on coming across these words and I read them online. I think I'm going to get this wrong, I swear to God. As soon as I try and say it, I've got to check it with somebody. Anyway, this is from 1968, and it's a designer called Wim Kruger.
Kruger.
I know, Kruger. But again, so my pronunciation is terribly off. And what he basically did is he just produced a post. He had actually had this grid printed for himself first. And then he actually drew in the type you can see. And he used this grid pretty much exclusively for all the work he did for that particular client. And he used a very similar grid, if not this one, for pretty much all the work that he did for his entire career, which is vast. And I guess goes to show how useful it can be if you like it. But, you know. I do it my way. I just couldn't resist this picture. I don't know why he was on the Spanish edition of Life magazine with that particular expression, but old Blue Eyes must have been really pleased that day when he saw it. And obviously he's got a tangerine called a Cardi, so I couldn't possibly resist that. But this is, I'm just going to run you through very quickly how I do this. First of all, people think that you've got to start off with the actual grid itself sometimes. You need the grid and then you work to the grid and you put everything in the grid. Well, I think that's...
Say it.
Bollocks. And the reason being is because the most important thing for me on the web is the body. It's the body text. Now that's what people see the most, and that's what they really need to understand. So I start with the body text. I select the typeface I want to use, which is usually one of the core web fonts. I select the size I want to use it at, and then I start to look at the line height or leading that's appropriate. So here, I don't know if you guys can even read this, but this is a 16px font size, effectively. 1EM, for guys who are used to working with EMs on the web. And it's a 20px line height, so it's 1.25EM line height in CSS. And because I worked this out, and I thought, actually, that looks nice, that's the kind of breathable space that I'm looking for. Then I took this value, 20px, which is the line height. And this is what I'm going to do fairly slowly, because some people will know this really well, but some others might not. And this is my This is what we call warm lead. This is my basic leading value. And from that, all other things will float from that one value. So therefore, I put 40 px, two leads effectively, gutters, margins, whatever you want to call them. And just because I would usually do this for most things, I just split the pages with an approximate ratio divide. With, you probably might not be able to see it, but with a 40 px. So I always start with the body sex. It's just it seems to be the way I work, and I'm not recommending to you as the most optimal one, but that's just the way that I do it. But I don't start with this overreaching kind of conceptual thing. I start with actually reading what this text is, and then trying to kind of find a way of actually presenting it which works for me. So once I've got what my body text size is going to be, and what my line height or one lead or basic leading is going to be, and in this case 20 px, everything else flows from there. So, there's the kind of 20 px horizontal line as part of the grid. Now, this is a web, bear in mind, this is not print. So, trying to do fixed width layouts with distinct areas, with say 100 pixels wide with a 10 pixel gutter or something like that. It makes sense if you're doing fixed width layouts, but I never do. I either do elastic layouts or I do liquid. That's all I do. So if you do fixed width, you can have a really strict horizontal and vertical grid if you want to, but I don't. So there you go. That's how I fit it. My grid evolves from my one lead, my 20 px, my basic leading value.
Can I just say, fixed width, I think it depends if... Right, so I experience a lot of websites with broken layouts because I've got a laptop with quite high resolution screen, so I bumped up the font size in the operating system and in the browser. And so whenever someone's used on a site, mix relative sizes with pixels with EMs.
It breaks the layout.
It just breaks. You get font overspilling over areas or underneath. And sometimes like really high profile sites. I contacted, for example, on gravitas.com, quite a well-known site. I was like, how do I delete this email address, something like that. And the guy was, oh, just click that and that. I was like, I can't see that. You know, there was a sort of volley of emails. Turned out it was hidden behind something else, some other element. I sent him a screenshot. It's like, oh, okay, it's not actually there, it's hidden. So, yeah, it happens all the time.
So
that sounds like using fixed heights, which is always another.
Fixed heights on.
Always. I mean, even if you go for fixed width, whatever, not my thing, I'm John there, but fixed height?
Yes, exactly.
For that very reason.
Yeah, for that exact reason. So, I mean, I'm always hesitant about preaching to the choir, but you know, the point is well made that really, if you can stay away from fixed width, stay away from them. I mean, browsers will handle them now. Browsers have built-in zoom, all apart from Safari, which is my browser of choice. And it'll pull up. And pardon?
Chrome.
And Chrome. Okay, I didn't realize that. I don't actually use Chrome. So Chrome is based on WebKit, which is probably why it's got the same characteristic. But Firefox and IE Next, IE7, I believe, and 8 will all have Zoom layouts. Opera has had a Zoom layout for time immemorial. So what that means is that a lot of designers think, oh, it doesn't matter anymore. I can just do fixed width layouts because the browser will handle all that stuff. That's an argument. I'm not even going to rebut it. I think it's up to people to make that choice for themselves in context. So, we have our basic, we have something that looks sort of like a grid. So then, you really don't like me. This is your machine, Rich. It's,
yeah. It's all right, it doesn't like me either.
Yeah. No, that's not working either. Is it going to sleep? Come on, guys. Okay, there we go. Where's the cursor button?
That's up above. Make it go down.
Oh,
pass it or love on with it?
It's up here.
Oh, is it? Oh, yeah. There we go.
Okay, let's try and put that on there. Okay, so, just to stick the head in. I mean, so, okay, so you know you've got this one value, I've got this one value that's really important to me, this 20 pixels, which is basically 1.25 EM. And I always convert everything to EMs by just working in pixels here for simplicity. So I want a header. So the important thing for me is to make that header some sort of multiple of that basic value. So the header becomes 40 pixels. And now, because my line height is 20 pixels, the line height of the header needs to match that. Because I wanted it to have some rhythm, vertical rhythm. So I have 40 pixels. Go ahead.
What if it wraps?
What if it wraps?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be, it's 1 EM, so there's enough space in there for a wrap. It's not 0.5 where there'd be some kind of crossover with descenders and ascenders and stuff like that. It's 1, so it's fine. Okay, so, but yeah, I mean, that could be a problem. If you need to fit it to a particular grid, this is where grids can kind of fall down. If you want to fit it to a particular baseline grid, and that happens to require a value here of 52 px line height, if it does wrap, it's going to look massive. So you've got to kind of think it through and test it out. But anyway, so 40 px font size, and the 40 pixel line height. Pretty simple. A multiple, basically. And then I go and keep on doing it for the rest of the page. So I put a header 2 in. That's where it gets interesting now. I've chosen a 24 px font size and a 40 px line height. And I'll tell you the reason why in a minute. And another one here, but this is where it starts to get a little bit more interesting. This is my asides. And you'll notice that these lines don't fall on my baseline grid. Well, they do, because look, that one does, that one does, that one does, that one does, and that one does. So they do, so this still retains the rhythm of the page, because every fourth line will fall on the grid. And it's calculated deliberately so. So it's a 12 px font size and it's a 16 px line height. So this is just a really brief overview. I don't want to kind of overspill the time too much. So have you guys got any questions about this? Does this, is there questions about it? Does it make sense, or am I losing you a little bit in how obvious I think this is?
Do you find that borders can be tricky because they can kind of throw out the rhythm? Since you stick a border on something, so do you try and include the measurement of the border into the...
By border, do you mean...
Like the physical border. Do you say border 1 pixel, do you say border any...
This is a really good point. Yeah, so say for example, there was a 1 pixel border dividing these two paragraphs. Now, as you can see here, I'm putting in a deliberate margin here so that it's basically the equivalent of the same of a one line, just so I keep the vertical rhythm. But if I put a 1 pixel border in that, it's going to throw that out ever so slightly, so you have to compensate for it. So if my line height here is 16 pixels, and my bottom margin is 16 pixels, and I have a border on it of 1 pixel. Actually, my bottom margin is then 17 pixels. So all I do is shrink the margin 1 pixel and add the border. And then we're good again. And I'm happy and I...
What if you're using m's? Would you calculate what 1 pixel border would be as an m value?
Default value, 1 pixel is 0.063 EM. On the web. It's actually 0.0625, but browsers don't handle 4 decimal places. Unfortunately, it should. My view. Come on, guys, what's wrong with you? You know, you're smart people, support it.
You say you design around you sort of read the copy and design around it. What happens if you don't get that first?
In that case, I give it a special name and I call it an emergent narrative. No, I mean this is the perennial problem, isn't it? That you don't necessarily know what the copy's going to be. But then you have an idea of the concept and the thrust of this particular platform and what it needs to do. And if you're not going to give people the ability to art direct or change the styles of their own stuff, then you just have to call the ball, don't you, really? And I think that becomes, you know, you just do that within the context of the site. I mean, we have... Jeremy might know more than me about this, but we have JavaScript methods to prevent things like orphans, and we have methods to prevent widows, and we have methods to help typography be better in an emergent narrative. But we don't have necessarily simple ways of doing that in CSS. They're usually kind of add-ons. But yeah, in that case, I would just call it in the best way that I could. And if it doesn't seem to fit after a while, then it doesn't fit. Did anybody read Jason Santamaria's recent article on 24 ways about art direction and about trying to prepare layouts for different images in different places and where they need to go? If you haven't read it, I recommend it to you, because it very much mirrors thoughts I've had in the past, where in an emergent narrative, when you're trying to build a layout like this and you don't know what the content's going to be, I'm going off on a tangent, but I'm going to be quick. You might want an image which is full width, you might want one which is half or whatever distance, you might want one which is pulled out slightly. You might want all sorts of different contexts of different layers of headers. You might want lists which are actually a list basically that looks kind of like that, those four lines. Or you might want ones that have a margin between each item. So you just have to design for it and decide, okay, in this case we're going to have to use a class for this particular kind of list. Actually, I call them a short list. Generally, I design lists with a margin in between each element, and then I design a short list and a short list class for people to use if they just want to do a short list. So I recommend Jason Santamaria's article to you, just to give you an idea of how to prepare an interface for different types of content. But the grid would still apply. So if I was putting images in here, and again, I didn't prepare the slide, I would make the images a multiple, again, of 20px, if I had to put them in, because it retains the rhythm then of the page. So rather than 198 or 64, I would make them a multiple.
John, when you're designing a web page with typography, starting with type, do you start in CSS? In HTML and CSS, or would you start?
I start actually with pencil or a whiteboard or something like that.
It sounds much easier to get this kind of rhythm in CSS than it would be in, say, Fireworks or Photoshop.
But taking a helicopter view for a second, each page has a certain number of objects that need to be on it, certain number of elements that need to be on it. And those elements are usually defined as some sort of research or analysis process, where you say, okay, what needs to be on this particular page, on this interface, in this particular context. So I plan those out actually usually longhand, or I use Scribble or something like that, just to draw out where I think things are going to be.
I think James is not sort of meaning the wireframing stuff. Just the planning of the flow of the type.
But yeah,
do you do that straight in CSS, or do you do it?
I was going to say, after I've done that bit, then I move straight to CSS. Because I have to look at it in context. I can't design this in Photoshop and have it look like it's going to look in all the different browsers. The only way to find out how my choice here is going to behave in all the different browsers is to have it available to them. So I guess, to answer your question, yes, on CSS, HTML, and I test as I go. Testing at the end is not always appropriate for all the reasons we've covered here about hinting and how fonts perform differently on different platforms. So I actually do this as I go. But the good news is that once you've broken the back of it, in the sense of once you've done all this sort of stuff, everything else flows pretty freely. And at the end, you don't have a huge bill of cross-browser issues to get around and any surprises. So, scale. The reason that the font sizes were 16, 24, and 40 is because of Fibonacci. Does anybody know who Fibonacci is? Any mathematicians, physicists in the audience?
Sorry?
Has anybody ever heard of Fibonacci?
Yeah.
Okay, alright. So you know what the sequence of numbers means. Basically, each value in the sequence is the sum of the previous two. And it gives us a curve like this. So rather than it being a straight line of regular increments, it's actually a curve. And Fibonacci also applies to layouts too. The golden ratio is an expression of
Fibonacci. Is that what you use for your columns? The left and right columns?
It is. Approximately, but I don't well. What is Fibonacci? What would you multiply it by? So say you want two columns, and you've got an interface which is 960 pixels wide, for example. You would divide that by 1.6 six, what is it,
1.618.
Okay, so I do 6.2, so I'm rounding it up a little bit. But that's going to give you usually a funny value. Well, actually, not a neat one. And I quite like neat values, so I usually round it down or up. Okay. So that's what I would usually do, is 960 pixels wide if I want two columns, and I want to have that golden ratio in there, divide by 1.62.
I think it was Mark Walton, who's one of the biggest advocates of the grid system, did a fantastic review on this about the golden... series on it, and one part was actually put mainly sort of more print layout, is that sort of your double page spread with you, and you can map it out basically, you've got an area.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's where it comes from, and that's the fact that that's what all book designers still do. So, yeah, effectively. I mean, they don't always have to. I mean, these are just kind of guidelines, really. I mean, this is kind of almost like a starting point. By understanding this stuff, then you can break these rules as often as you want to, and you're good, as long as you know you're breaking them. But it's always good to have some sort of rules to follow, at least in the early stages. I always find that. But I encourage you to find out a little bit more about this Fibonacci sequence. His real name was Leonardo da Pisa. Oh, just in case you're curious. Yes?
Got a little tidbit. The ratio 1.618 or whatever it is. If you subtract one from that, it works the same way, but in reverse, which is quite handy sometimes.
Yeah, I wish I was a better mathematician.
It does that. It's the only ratio where you can do that. It's really cool.
Yeah. Kenneth actually drew me a graph earlier to explain this stuff. Because he's got a big brain. This pattern is repeated everywhere. So a spiral is a manifestation of these sort of calculations being applied in nature, and it appears in a lot of places. But it might be useful. It's an aesthetic judgment you make. But that's why the font size. Just to name this, by the way, this is not a traditional scale. Typography has a traditional scale, and this is not it. But it might be something you're interested in finding out about if you want to find out more about how to size different different headers or whatever in an interface. Okay, sorry, skipping on. Ah, too many. Where am I? Why is this doing? Okay. So, guys, you'll be close enough. We're very close to the end now. So, it's not much longer. That was all the science bit. That's all the kind of like rules and regulations and stuff you could apply in the way that I do it with the science of typography. But what about the art? By the way, again, a real person painting an aircraft. Just a great picture for me.
Wow.
Talking about great pictures. I mean, I'm not a fan of conflicts in general, but if ever Action Man had a model, it was this dude. really, the only point in me putting this up here is to say to you that all these rules that I've just told you are really a framework to work within, and actually I break them regularly. The typography on the web has got a long way to go, but we can apply all these things that I've been talking about, as Rich will show you shortly. But once you've applied them a couple of times, then you start to think, well, there may be more interesting ways of doing stuff. And that's kind of where the fun is. That's where... Have you ever thrown a grenade? I've never thrown a grenade. I'm just curious about what it feels like to pull a pin and throw a grenade. But yeah, grids, no, grenades, maybe. And there's a great quote, and I'm just going to end on this, because I'm not going to go into the art, because art is about aesthetics, really. It's about personal judgment. It's about what something else means. So the reason this was called 80% science and 20% art is because the art is really not the most important bit. Science is the most important bit of understanding how to use the science of typography on the web to do the things that you want to do. The art is really totally personal in a way. And you know, anybody can take the science, mold it, shape it, take it apart, throw grenades at it, and still do really interesting stuff. Because a guy I met the other day gave me this quote. An object can never compete with an experience. And fundamentally, what we're designing, or what we build on the web, we build experiences, don't we? And typography is just one component in that experience that lends a flavour to the experience that people have. And this was really an artist called, this is a quote from an artist called Hamish Fulton, who's described as a walking artist, which I find great. What these guys, it comes from a school of artists, and what they decided is that they don't want to make objects, they don't want to make things for people to admire or to touch or to have in their home or something like that. What they really wanted to do is to say that they don't really want to sell stuff either. So they were, I kind of like that idea. So what they did is they created walks that became an immersive experience of art. And the guy that I met at the local coffee shop by my office, or coffee stand, I should say, takes it a step further. He's a walking artist, and he puts headphones on people. So this great story, I'm just going to wrap up on this very one last thing, to say that illustrates this point that objects, designs, static designs can never compete with actual interactive experiences. In Devon, there was the last dairy farmer in a particular area was going out of business. And his herd was being destroyed. He had to convert his land to do something else. And as an expression of kind of an objection to this, he created an exhibition where people could go down, put on a set of headphones, and take a walk. And the walk went through a tunnel and up a hill to the top of a hill. And as you walk through the tunnel, all you would hear the sound of your own footsteps, just sort of walking along. And he played with the audio for this as well. I'll send it to me rather, and it was great. And then as you come out of the tunnel and start going up the hill, you start to hear this very faint sound. And it's the sound of Tesco's. And as you get a little bit further up the hill, apparently, according to the audio at least, I was trying to map it in my head, you suddenly go in the door of Tesco's, you hear that shh, shh, and you're inside Tesco's. So you're outside, but you're hearing Tesco's all around you is Tesco's, it's all going on. And you get to the top of the hill, and you're hearing the milk bottles sound, or milk, some kind of sloshing kind of sound in Tesco's. And you get to the top of the hill, and you come out of the door and hear it. And suddenly you're at the top of the hill, and you've got this amazing view over Devon. And that was his way of expressing that, first of all, an objection to Tesco's ruining the milk production in a given area for whatever reason. And secondly, just showing how the experience is much more important than the actual object at the end of the day. And that's it. Has anybody got any questions? So, anyone got any questions? Great, okay. thanks for your attention, I really appreciate it. Cheers.
We're going to take a quick 15-minute break. I'd like to say a thank you again to John, who's come down from Bristol for this and put a lot of time and effort into it. So, if you want to ask him any questions, have a beer with him now and there. Thanks again, John.